Ragtime to Rock and Roll. Episode 24, Trad and Other Fads. Kenneth Moore hears the old jazz at New Orleans turning into a new popular music for the old world. He brushes up his three B's, ball, barber, and bilk, and sees the do-it-yourself habit spread to music in the form of skiffle. He follows skiffle to Soho, and there comes face-to-face with the beginning of the end of our story.
The tributaries of popular music are often every bit as interesting as the mainstream. As a matter of fact, now and again, one of them will flow so strongly that you begin to wonder for a moment which is which. In the middle 50s, several of them met in such a whirlpool of noise that the music business itself wasn't quite sure. As we heard last week, one result of this confusion was the entertainment which offered traditional jazz, skiffle, big band swing, and early rock and roll all on one bill. Well, we know from experience that to follow any stream of popular music back to its starting point is like tracing the source of the White Nile. All the same, we're going to try. Now, take trad, for instance. The name was just a handy abbreviation for traditional jazz, and it was coined, I suppose, at about the time it started getting popular enough for the business to take notice of it. Now, where this particular stream rose out of the ground is the subject of much argument. You can follow it, if you want to, right back to New Orleans via New York and Chicago. But as far as this country is concerned, we'll go along with a convention that puts it in the northwest corner of Kent, the Red Barn, Bexley Heath, where this sound was born. Themselves George Webb's Dixielanders, and they came into being in the first place partly because a bunch of like-minded enthusiasts happened to be thrown together in a wartime munitions factory. The other reason was that the good musicians who played at the local rhythm club were getting so much work outside that George Webb's collection of amateurs, as they were then, became the resident band.
When we first started playing, all the people who were down there was used to listening to small John Kirby arrangement stuff. We had a big band down there. They was horrified by our sound, and they left the whole, you know, en bloc within about 4 or 5 weeks. We was down to about 20 people because, it was based loosely on a mixture of Dixieland, original Dixieland numbers, Chicago tunes, which play washboard stuff, with muted trumpet and washboard. A lot of people found their way down there. Gradually, the music, we had to get better, but it couldn't have got any worse.
By the time they came to record, the Webb Dixielanders had been in existence some while. Their very early years were a triumph of enthusiasm over incompetence. They were encouraged, of course, by the loyalty of their following. In George Webb's band was clarinetist Wally Fawkes, now even more famous as the cartoonist and illustrator Trog. And it wasn't long before they were joined by the man who was able to give one whole section of the traditional movement an identity. Ex-Guards officer, old Etonian descended from an upper-class diplomatic family, Humphrey Lyttelton had everything the press needed. That he was also enormously talented was almost irrelevant at the time. He was, in a word, colourful.
Hump strolled in his father's overcoat, which would look like a tent, pulled down to his ankles, and his, I think he had his officer's khaki shirt with an odd collar, and looked, you know, as Hump always did, a bit bizarre, I might say. And immediately everybody kind of, who is this character? Because certainly started playing. People took off because he sat in and played. He's a very shy man, Lyttelton. He came along and, you know, you'd have to press gang him into playing. He was one of them guys who wanted to jump on to show how good he was.
Well, he may have been modest, but he had assurance and personality. And before very long, it had ceased to be George Webb's band and had become Humphrey Lyttelton's. Humphrey Lyttelton's early band plays their version of the Thin Red Line. An indication, by the way, of Hump's lifelong but little-known interest in military and brass band music. It may have been Hump's background and his personal newsworthiness. It may even have been something about the music itself. But the Lyttelton band was drawn into the conventional entertainment scene remarkably early on.
We did a Melody Maker. You know, they used to have the competitions, Melody Maker contests all over the country, and they always had a resident band to play on the shows as well, and hitherto all the resident bands had been dance bands, because it was called, I think, the Melody Maker Dance Band Contest, and so they'd always had regular dance bands. And I think we did the first one as early as 1949. We had a terrible row with the people because we all shambled on, you know, in the wrong clothes and everything, because we were really at that stage just banging around playing this music for fun. But we were very much within the sort of dance band establishment at that early stage. it was a mixed thing, because the people who'd been dancing to Ted Heath and to the sundry American bands, presumably including Glenn Miller's and things like that, during the war years, had this modification of jitterbug dancing, which was called jiving, which is a fairly fluent and comprehensible style of dancing. But when we started, we had a lot of people coming from art schools, and it was really like a sort of primitive way of teaching people how to swim, in that we started to play and they flung themselves on the floor and literally flailed about. And we were bounced from that first club because it was over a restaurant, and hunks of plaster fell off the ceiling into people's soup downstairs.
The word underground hadn't been applied at that time to anything other than the French resistance movement and a mode of transport. But that's what Humphrey Lyttelton's music was, basically. Underground music played to a literally and figuratively underground audience.
I think that it's a lot of the people who went to art schools went because they were, at that time, the sort of center of the revolt of the young people. In other words, the new universities hadn't really expanded yet, and it was the art schools where you went if you wanted to shock your parents and show that you had brand new ideas about everything. The thing that's interested me about the whole popular music thing, which started with this jazz thing, is how Tin Pan Alley, which in the 30s was in control, if somebody in an office in Denmark Street said, "I've got a new dance, we call it the Palais Glide," and they made a chart with a couple of sort of footprints on it, you know, like they do dance charts. And then through the media, in other words, through the trade papers and things, they launched it, and the dance bands were told how to play it, and the band leaders told the audience how to dance it, and things like the Palais Glide and all those, even the Hokey Cokey and those things, all started, they were hatched up. And then after the war, and when the dance band thing was beginning to decline, it went on for a while, of course, with Ted Heath and Dickie Valentine, Lita Rose and all that, but from underneath there were all these people from art schools and elsewhere cramming into the subterranean clubs.
Every now and again, a record would appear from the traditional jazz side of the fence, catch the public's fancy, and do quite well commercially. They never sold in quite the same quantities of, say, a David Whitfield or later on an Elvis Presley, but they were undeniably hits. The pleasant thing about them is that they were usually almost accidental, often being recorded casually as afterthoughts. Humph's biggest success was with his own composition, Bad Penny Blues, and it's typical of what used to happen.
It's the corniest story in the world and sounds, every time I tell it, as though I made it up on the spur of the moment. But it was a fact that we were doing a recording in a studio and that something was wrong with the circuit. So they moved us to a smaller room where they said, you know, can you do something to go? We've got one side, these were 78 singles. We've got one side in the can and we want to do another one. Is there something you can do that will go on the other side, but we can't get the full band in this studio? So we actually did the Bad Penny Blues, which we used to play in the clubs a lot, and just threw it away. And I went off on holiday, and when I came back, Jack Jackson had taken it up, and he was the man who put it across. You know, he had his record show.
Penny Blues, and it still comes up fresh even now, 18 years after it was minted. The reasons for Jack Jackson, that uncanny diviner of hit records, getting behind it in the 50s were musical. After all, Jack had been a magnificent trumpet player himself, and knew a good brass man when he heard one. Perhaps it would be useful at this stage to mention why there should have been any such thing as traditional jazz at all to influence popular music in Britain. It came about because sometime in the 1940s, such following as there was for jazz in this country suddenly split itself neatly down the middle. One half became fascinated by the new and complex jazz made by Charlie Parker and the other musical revolutionaries and eagerly went in pursuit, anxious to know where jazz was going. The other half was much more interested in where it had been and set off doggedly back towards the roots. These traditionalists, like nonconformists, followed the same basic religion but tended to worship in a number of different sectarian chapels. The audience for early 50s Littleton wouldn't necessarily be the one for early 50s Chris Barber. We'll be right back. rightly or wrongly, Chris Barber is one of the musicians who will always be associated with what came to be known as the trad boom. It was the alliterative trio of Barber, Ball and Bilk who stamped their names on the public consciousness. They all had hits at one time or another. Chris Barber's evolution started in the late 40s in the evangelical days of the New Orleans Revival. Over a matter of musical policy, he pulled Ken Collier's band from under him in 1954 and set off on his own account. What he played happened to appeal to a steadily widening audience. Here, Chris describes the growth of a following.
I mean, with Collier, 53, we started out with about three nights a week work. And that time was when the Wilcox brothers signed up the London Jazz Club, they called it, under the church behind the Cumberland Hotel, Ranson Street, where it was called. We had a good crowd there, and Humph still had a big crowd at 100 Oxford Street Club. And by the end of the year with Collier, it got to a point where we were sort of working in six different clubs a week, and they were all pretty full. But, I mean, this is only sort of an average of 200 or 300 people each night. So I took the band over. We had those same residences still, the same six. And we began touring. It was about a year later, I would say, that it began getting to a stage where we did concerts, just ordinary concerts going on with traditional bands, British traditional bands playing. That began in 54, 55. By 56, it was in full swing. Boom, you know, and it was amazing. I mean, so 56, we played Newcastle City Hall, which is 2,800-seater, five separate times in 1956. And they were all full in advance.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris Barber using a Louis Armstrong favorite, It's Tight Like That, to introduce the members of his band, recorded not in the Newcastle City Hall, but in the Royal Festival Hall. But the point is made, I think. Traditional jazz was starting to spill over into the world of commerce. It was, you remember, a time when practically anything stood a chance.
We hadn't ever had a traditional jazz thing. See, in America, in the 20s, well, we had Jack Hilton playing the Charleston, they had Gerald Morton playing the Charleston sort of thing. They had received the impact of this rather more emotional and rhythmic version of that music there, which we hadn't in Europe. I mean, it was beginning with Dixieland, with Harry Gold and Freddie Randall. They were doing very well in the late 40s. I mean, the Squadron Ages had a Dixieland section during the war. I mean, Dixieland was not, by any means, unknown, but it was just, there was obviously a vacuum in popular music at the time.
There was a lot of loose talk about a trad boom, which at this distance seems exaggerated. It didn't last long, and only a comparatively small number of musicians benefited from it to any extent. Nevertheless, it's true that in the late 50s, someone calculated that on any given night, there were probably 300 traditional bands at work somewhere in Britain. Certainly, the prospects must have looked good, for if we move on to 1958, we come to the forming of two bands which are still household names: Acker Bilks and Kenny Balls. Acker Bilks' Paramount Jazz Band is especially interesting to us, for it received almost the full promotional treatment. In odd contrast with Acker's North Somerset accent and directness, the band's publicity was couched in a kind of music hall chairman's rhetoric, while the band itself was dressed in striped waistcoats and bowler hats. We asked Acker Bilk if he thought they were necessary to get him anywhere.
I don't think they were. I don't think they were. A gimmick is really necessary. The thing I like to say about it, most of the work we were doing in them days, when Peter Leslie thought up the idea of waistcoats and bowler hat, were in jazz clubs, which you never wore in. You never wore uniform. Nobody wears uniform in jazz clubs. And the only people that saw us was if we'd done a posh dance, which was also rare in them days, or maybe a concert. And we'd done one or two television shows. But I think it got us in the public eye, and that's what it was intended to do. I think it ran away a bit. I mean, a lot of the jazzers said, oh, you know, there's so many people caught on to this. Everybody was wearing different things. But, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I mean, if you want to dress up a bit for a bit of publicity, why not? I mean, Louis used to clown around. He didn't dress up so much. But the point is, if the music's good, the people are going to come again. They can only come once to see a guy in a bowler hat and a waistcoat, you know.
Thank you. Knackerbilk's highly individual clarinet sound, already well developed on that early recording of Somerset. The third member of the trad trio is Kenny Ball. And although it takes this part of our story rather far forward, the background to one of Kenny's hits does bring in something we haven't paid much attention to so far, television. The man who looked after the recording side of Kenny Ball's career at the end of the 50s was producer Alan Freeman, telling here of the making of the first of Kenny's big successes.
It was his idea to record Samantha. And he said, I'd like to sing on it. And I laughed because I'd never heard him sing. I said, I'd play great trumpet, but, you know, he said, well, why don't you listen to me? So I listened to him, and I thought it was fabulous. Now, Lonnie didn't like it, but I can't understand why. But we went in the studio one Sunday afternoon about 4 o'clock in the winter, which must be the coldest time of the day to go into a recording studio. And we started work on this thing. And by 7 o'clock, I think we had it in the can. And I thought it was fantastic. And we went with it, and he got marvellous reaction from the BBC, got tremendous airplay. And then the thing suddenly got into the bottom of the charts. I think it came in at number 18. They were only, if I remember rightly, only printing top 20s in those days. Got in at 18. And it was the time Sunday night at the London Palladium was running as probably the number one television show. So I got on to my old friend Leslie Grade and said, is there any chance of getting Kenny Ball band in on Sunday? He said, none whatsoever. Parnell hasn't seen the act. And you know he won't put anything on that he hasn't seen. So I said, but it's absolutely vital to me. I think this can be a monster hit if they can have even the opening spot, 5 minutes. So Leslie said, I'll come back to you within 2 hours. And he did come back. He said, I've spoken to Bowell. I've told him how convinced you are. And he said, you can have the opening spot this Sunday. And they went on, and they wowed them. They did a fantastic spot. They tore the place down, and the next week the record was right up there, about number 4.
I love you, Samantha, and my love is never gonna die. Remember, oh Samantha, I'm a one-gal guy. And together, my Samantha, we could ride a star and ride it high. Please remember, my Samantha, I'm a one-gal guy. Then in some distant day, you should come to me and say, get away, go away, goodbye. Remember, oh Samantha, I'm a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 gal guy.
Cole Porter's song, rather unexpectedly, making the hit parade of 1961, thanks to Kenny Ball's version of I Love You, Samantha. Now, for once, a kind of neatness appears in the disordered musical history of the period. And although we're forced to double back on our tracks yet again, the link from Kenny Ball to a musical movement of the previous decade is very real. The man who recommended that the Kenny Ball band should be given a record contract in the first place was Lonnie Donegan, the very personification of the skiffle movement in this country, a movement which for a while assumed an importance out of all proportion to its humble beginnings.
Somebody's digging my potatoes, trampling on my vine. Well, I had a worried feeling, rest on my mind. Yeah, tell me. I crept up to the window, thought I heard a moan, but I heard somebody say, oh, you suckin' my sweet bone. Yes, you digging my potatoes. Yes, I had a worried feeling resting on my mind. Now my vines was all green, my potatoes red. I thought you was my friend till I caught you in my bed. Yes, you digging my potatoes, resting on my mind.
Donnie Donegan was one of a group of amateur traditional jazz musicians who gravitated together in the late 1940s to form the very first Chris Barber Band. He played the banjo and guitar, and he'd learned a lot of obscure blues and folk songs from records borrowed from the American Library in Grosvenor Square. And this is where it all ties up into one tidy bundle. For skiffle was an offshoot of the traditional jazz movement and began in the most casual way. Lonnie takes up the story himself.
Well, what we used to do then, in the interval, in the band break, instead of leaving the place silent, I and three or four of the guys used to get up and sing bits of blues and folk songs to keep things going, and also to, in the context of what we were playing, to try and illustrate the origins of the jazz that we were playing. Because at that time, don't forget, nobody knew what the hell we were doing, so we were kind of educators, you know. Self-styled educator. So we had to give the group that got up in the interval a name. You see, you couldn't call it the group that gets up in the interval to illustrate the origins of jazz. You could. Unwieldy on a poster. So we found the nearest description we could find to what we were doing was skiffle, which was, once again, an esoteric Negro phrase somewhat similar to the original use of the word jazz. Slightly scatological, little sexual overtones, and I think it was used in relation to parties, rent house parties, which the poor of that mid-30s period would hold to get a collection going for the rent, you see. And the kind of music that would be pervaded at those meetings was very ad-lib, obviously, amateur, obviously, with popular folk and jazz mixtures of the day, you see, and we figured that's about what we were doing. So we called ourselves a skiffle group. And that's how it started.
Well, John Henry told his little woman, gonna cook my supper soon. I got 90 miles of track, I'm going to line. Gonna line them by the light of the moon. Lord, Lord, gonna line them by the light of the moon. John Henry was a steel driver. He was the best in the land. And he died with his hammer in his hand. I should tell you all about it now. Well, John Henry told his captain, now a man ain't nothing but a man. But before I let your steam drill beat me down, gonna die with that hammer in my hand. Lord, Lord, gonna die with that hammer in my hand. How John Henry told his captain, but a man ain't nothing but a man. But before I let your steel drill beat me down, gonna die with that hammer in my hand. Lord, Lord, gonna die with that hammer in my hand. Heard your Henry had a little woman, and the dress that she wore was red. Well, she started up a track, Lord, she never looked back. I'm going where John Henry lies dead. Lord, Lord, going where John Henry lies dead. Ah, John Henry went down to Washington, and he buried him in the sand. And the people from the east, Lord, the people from the west, ain't seen such a steel-driving man. Yeah, Lord, ain't seen such a steel-driving man. Why, there's some say he's from England.
Denver, Louisiana, Maine. It's leader of the steam driving gang. Lord, Lord, it's leader of the steam driving gang.
We made our first LP and they released a side from it as a single. And for a jazz record of that day, the result was phenomenal, you know, and of course we were delirious about it. But the numbers in which they sold reflected only the number of followers the band had. So it was a very good result, but it wasn't more than we had hoped for. But when the skiffle side was released, Rock On Line, which was only a last resort because it was the last track left on the album to release. So they just thought, well, one more, put it out, what the hell. And somebody played it as a novelty song, obviously, on a pop radio show. And it caught on. We didn't know about it until we read about it in the Record Mirror, I believe it was, in those days. And we saw it in the Hit Parade, number, I don't know, 8 or whatever it was. And one of the boys said, hey, Rock On Line, number 8 in the Hit Parade. I said, where? Come on, you're kidding. And they said, I said, no, it's a gag. And then they said, oh, that's funny. Isn't that funny? And we laughed. We didn't realise the importance of that little line, Rock Island Line, number 8 in the Hit Parade. We didn't know about that world, you know. And then it crept up the charts, you see, to number 1 or whatever it was. And every week I'd have a sly look and chuckle to myself. But we still didn't realise until people started saying, well, who's your manager? I said, well, I'm talking about manager. Banjo player. I don't have managers, you know. And then eventually a guy comes from America and said, you know, you want to go on TV in America? I said, are you serious? Who's going to pay the fare? And I said, well, we'll pay your fare, son. I said, wow, well, how am I going to live over? They said, well, we'll give you a little money. Wow, you know, that's fantastic, you know. So I took just leave of absence from the band for a couple of weeks was all it was. I went to America and did the Perry Como show.
Now this here's the story about the Rock On Line. Rock Island Line, she runs down into New Orleans. And just outside of New Orleans, there's a big toll gate. And all the trains, they go through the toll gate while they gotta pay the man some money. But of course, if you got certain things on board, you're okay, you don't have to pay the man nothing. And just now, we see a train, she coming down the line. And when she come up near the toll gate, the driver, he shout down to the man. He say, I got pigs, I got horses, I got cows, I got sheep. I got all livestock, I got all livestock, I got all livestock. And the man say, well, you all right, boy, just get on through. You don't have to pay me nothing. And the train go through. And when he go through the toll gate, the train got up a little bit of steam and a little bit of speed. And when the driver think he's safely on the other side, he shout back down the line to the man. He said, I fooled you, I fooled you. I got pig iron, I got pig iron, I got all pig iron. I'll tell you where I'm going, boy. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride. Yes, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. I may be right, may be wrong. You know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride. Yes, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Hallelujah, I'm safe from sin. The good Lord's coming for to see me again. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride. Yeah, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. A, B, C, W, H, Y, Z. Cat's on the cover, but he don't see me. Down the Rock Island Line, the Rock Island Line is a road to ride. Yes, the Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you gotta ride it like you find it. Get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. Rock Island Line is a road to ride. Yes, the Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you gotta ride it like you find it. Get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
Lonnie Donegan and Rock Island Line represented the skiffle movement at its most commercially successful. But this strange byproduct of trad was more than just a commodity. It was actually of the people, popular in that real sense. It was relatively easy to play, and the songs are about things which are always preoccupations with the young. Of oppression, freedom, injustice, travel, crime, the land. Moon and June had no part in them. If the models were basically American, what then? Ever since ragtime itself, the inspiration had come from America. So, with little technique but much zeal, the youth of Britain took to the guitar and washboard. That they were increasingly large numbers to do so was probably due to the phasing out of conscription. Popular music and social history were closer to each other than they'd been since the great days of music hall. Wally Wyton remembers the atmosphere and one special institution of those times.
I think the most important thing that happened from my point of view and from my contemporaries' point of view was really the coming of coffee bars, because once you got too old for a youth club, there was nowhere to go anymore. You obviously didn't want to stay at home and watch television or listen to the radio, so you would go out and it was either a pub or nowhere. And I think the coming of coffee bars meant that for the first time young people could sit without being hustled, you know. And lots of the owners, especially around Soho, didn't mind if you took in guitars and instruments. And this is the way I really got started. You know, I think I knew about six songs that I got from some book or other when I first started going into coffee bars, and I was learning a song a day from other singers. And gradually it became a kind of strict scene, whereas everybody, I mean, at one time or another in the coffee bar in Soho, there would be probably 14 or 15 singers. This gradually became, it got to where you didn't want certain people to sing, and we made ours a hard-line group. In other words, there were five of us, and that was it. We didn't play with other people. And we sat down one evening after the coffee bar had closed and called ourselves the Vipers, and that really was it.
As I was walking that ribbon of highway, above me, an endless skyway. I saw below me a golden valley. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me.
We were literally an overnight success, and the coffee bar that was doing no business at all, the Two Eyes, was packed. And I think other coffee bar owners saw this, and of course it meant other kids would go into coffee bars and ask if they could play, and literally within a period of, it must have been 3 or 4 months, the whole of Compton Street, and in fact almost the whole of Soho, was full of bands playing, skiffle groups in the cellars, you know.
To the connoisseurs, and everybody under the age of 20 was a connoisseur, there was a difference between the sound of trad band skiffle and coffee bar skiffle.
The difference would be, I think, the drums and the bass of the trad bands backing up their skiffle groups, a much heavier beat to it. We were sort of working up from the bottom with £2 guitars and couldn't afford bass players, and certainly, you know, that was a very expensive item. Ours was a much thinner sound, the sound of guitars, 3, 4, sometimes 5 guitars. Slightly more towards country music, and the other band slightly more towards jazz in the feel, I think. There was always, to me, an essential difference between, say, the sound of Lonnie all the way through his career and, say, the sound of the Vipers or Chas McDevitt.
Freight train, going so fast, freight train, going so fast. I don't know what train he's on, won't you tell me where he's gone? Don't know where he's heading for, what he's done against the law, but got no future, got no hope, just nothing but the road. Freight train, freight train, going so fast. I don't know what train he's on. Won't you tell me where he's gone? Ooh.
Freight train, the Chas McDevitt interpretation of Skiffle with Nancy Whiskey. One day somebody will really go into the social significance of the 1950s coffee bars that Wally Wyton spoke about. As in their 18th century counterparts, the coffee houses, a deal of political consciousness flourished amid the apparent frivolity. Only this time the clientele was a young generation with its own outlook and its own music. Sidney Carter, an author, poet and performer who inhabits a rather personal territory between the cabaret and folk world, noticed this about the period.
Well, the strange thing was that skiffle seemed to occur about the same time as the Aldermast and March and the general revival of political awareness. Because remember, they'd also had the Hungarian Revolution, and so everything was sort of going round in 1956 to 57. Skiffle had started earlier, and people were singing songs of social significance, whether they were about Lead Belly and jail and stuff, or now about the bomb. Quite a lot of stuff about the bomb was going around. And the whole CND tie-up with the folk revival was quite strong. One thing, you've got a sort of pilgrimage, sort of serious yet festive thing in the Aldermast and March. I don't think it really happened since the time of Chaucer or something like that. You know, it's a wonderful field for music to come out of. It's like the old camp meetings. It's sort of religious, it's sexy, it's political, it's idealistic, and it's youth, and spring's coming, and death is hovering, you know, black flags with daffodils on. Somehow it was, as I say, almost like Middle Ages, and I think that really did affect the sort of stuff that's being listened to and written at that time.
Sidney Carter mentioned the folk revival in the same breath as skiffle, and that's where it all becomes really intriguing, for in that coffee bar culture, many streams of music ran side by side.
It was an incredible mixture, because the very first coffee bar I ever went into, I met up with Tommy Steele, who was then a merchant seaman, and Tommy was singing rock and roll, which he'd heard in the States, which didn't mean a thing to me at that time. There was another artist I worked as a commercial artist, another artist I worked with, Mike Pratt, played sort of ragtime things. We had another friend that we met in a coffee bar, Lionel Bart, who went on to great things. And it was incredible, because I would do a Burl Ives song, then Tommy would do a rock and roll song. Then I'd do a calypso, because coming from Camden Town, naturally, I knew lots of calypsos. And it would go on like this. A tremendous different kinds of music. You know.
The old time cave dweller lived in a cave. This is what he did when he wanted to rave. He took a stick and he drew on the wall. Man out of hell, I had himself a ball. Rock with a caveman. Roll with a caveman. Shake with a caveman. Baby, make with a caveman. Oh, boy. Tight style of mind, I hold your baby very tight. His way with women was rather neat. Love a girl right off her feet. You know the lyric writers never lied. Where they got the same story, I rock with a caveman. Roll with the caveman. Shake with the caveman. Break with the caveman. Oh,
I found that when I came back to England in 1956, that I arrived equipped with something that nobody had heard about, a thing called rock and roll. And England was ready for something new. The teenagers were slowly starting to dictate that they wanted what they wanted, and if one of their own, I suppose, could give it to them, then all well and good.
Sings this song. Archaeologists done me wrong. British Museum's got my head. Most fortunate, cause I ain't dead. Rock with a caveman. Roll with a caveman. Shake with a caveman. Break with a caveman. Make with a caveman. C-A-B-E M-E-N caveman.
Tommy Steele had arrived, and with him, as you heard him say, rock and roll. We'd had an inkling of it from a film called Blackboard Jungle, and as we know from last week, British musicians who'd worked in America, like Pitt Lewis and Freddie Randall, had encountered it in the flesh. But it was Tommy Steele who actually brought it here, packed like samples in his guitar case, so to speak. He soon ran into a Fleet Street photographer named John Kennedy, who was as much a stranger to management as Tommy was to show business. Kennedy, nevertheless, quickly expanded Tommy's coffee bar circuit to include, of all improbable places, the Stork Club in London.
And it was there that I was introducing, for the first time to British audiences, rock and roll. Because being in America for all those years and living there for 18 months at one time, I'd heard the songs and heard the rhythms and heard the colours that we were getting together in those days, that I was able to bring them to England firsthand. And I remember the opening song that I used to do in my act was a number called Blue Suede Shoes, sung by a very unknown Elvis Presley. No one had heard of him, and no one had heard of Blue Suede Shoes. But I remember the first night walking onto the stage at the Stork Club with an amplifier turned up to the highest decibels that it was. I probably killed the first two rows of the stalls. A drummer that I insisted played offbeats, which was the second and fourth beats of the bar. And he said, well, don't you want any fill-ins? And I said, no, just play offbeats. And a bass player that I asked to play closer to the microphone.
Well, we didn't know it at the time, but those Blue Suede Shoes were helping to beat a pathway to Britain along which a whole new culture would invade us. To the music business itself, rock and roll would look like just another, if noisier, fad. At that particular moment, indeed, skiffle was bigger and so was trad. But the popularity of those two, impressive as it was for a time, was as nothing compared with the impact and the fortunes that rock and roll would make. Needless to say, it didn't kill everything else off, as we shall see next week. But by the second half of the 50s, it had made it obvious that it was trad that was the fad, as Chris Barber reminds us.
But, Missy, it didn't become as popular as all that in the trad boom. I mean, Elvis was still top of the hit parade.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lone Street, that heartbreak hotel around me. I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely. I'll be just a lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. Be so, I'll be just a lonely baby. I'll be just a lonely, I'll be so lonely, I'll make it die.
Ragtime to Rock and Roll was narrated by Kenneth Moore and written by Peter Clayton. The research was by Bill Sullivan, and the producer was John Billingham. Next week, in The Rock Sets In, Kenneth Moore cites Halley's Comets, clocks Presley's progress, but reminds us that the late 50s were not all solid rock.